Star Trekkin' Across the Universe, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Andrew Fasekas joins us to talk about his new National Geographic book that uses Star Trek to introduce the wonders of astronomy. Wait till you see the images of Mars that senior editor Emily Lakdawala has gotten from India's Mars Orbiter mission. Bill Nye wants NASA to make a date with the Red Planet, and we'll learn why you shouldn't mess with Bruce Betts in this week's edition of What's Up. Some gorgeous new images, Emily. Tell us about these pictures of Mars.
Well, these aren't exactly new images. They are newly released images, though. It's the first formal release of science quality data from the Mars Orbiter mission. That's the Indian Space Agency's Mars Orbiter mission. And they've finally done a public release of science data from all their instruments. Of course, the one instrument I'm most interested in always is the camera. And I spent a while downloading the 517 photos that they released, and they really are quite unusual and very pretty.
And I know you spent days processing these, and boy, that work really shows off well here. What is so special about this camera? It's not high-rise.
No, it's absolutely not high-rise. In fact, it's pretty much the opposite of high-rise. High-rise, of course, is the camera on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that takes pictures so detailed that you could use them for hiking maps. They use them to plan rover traverses. But each image only covers a tiny fraction of Mars. The Mars Color camera, ISRO's Mars Orbiter mission, is basically the opposite. It's a very wide-angle camera. It's got a field of view that's designed so that when the orbiter is at its farthest reach from Mars, it is able to take in all of the planet in one view. It's also a color camera, like the ones on Curiosity. And so that means that it takes these basically magazine cover quality photos of the globe of Mars. It's not really going to lead to new science, but these are such valuable context images that allow you to point at a photo and say, this is the place I'm talking about. Now let's zoom in and go check out these other more detailed images.
So what is this sort of open letter that you've written to the Mars Orbiter team?
Well, the global images that Mars Orbiter mission takes they're unique. They only took full globe views right at the beginning of the mission when the apoapsis of the orbit, the farthest reach, they were able to view a fully lit Mars or a nearly fully lit Mars. Now they've changed the orbit so that they see fully lit Mars when they're closest to Mars, and they're shooting all their pictures there. If they shot a picture of Mars from apoapsis, they'd see it as a crescent, which I think they've decided not to do because of what scientific value is a crescent image of Mars. Has little scientific value, but so much emotional value. I'm begging them to shoot those photos. They'd be published in books for decades to come.
Well, I hope they're listening, but regardless, nice work, Emily, and thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you, Matt.
She's our senior editor, the planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Now let's stop in and talk with Bill Nye. Several things to talk about today, including a little bit of a tease for the new space policy edition, because you had a concern that comes right out of the discussion in that show about NASA planning.
Well, there's a couple news articles, and one of them just says NASA has no plans beyond the 2020 rover with respect to Mars, the Martian landing of the 2020 rover. And that's been the problem. And you could see why the people in Guadalajara were so excited to hear Elon Musk present SpaceX's plan for going to Mars in 2025 or whatever it is. I don't know if you're of a certain age, Matt. George Thorogood and the Destroyers had a hit with Set a Day, where he was asking his girlfriend to pick a day for them to interact.
Get hitched. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yes. Let's go get hitched. And so without setting a day, there's no pressure to complete anything. And this is where it gets back to this thing. You know, they've done studies. Students are more productive when there's a deadline.
Oh, yeah.
When students don't have a deadline, their work isn't as good quality.
I always say deadlines are magic.
They're your friend. And so if the next administrator of NASA, working with the next president of the United States and with international partners, was able to negotiate with everybody to set a day to bring back samples from Mars or to land, pick a number, 10 tons on Mars, whatever, then things would be getting done rather than having articles like the one that appeared this morning about NASA having amorphous plans. Hmm. But I think these things are all connected. It's a solvable problem.
Absolutely. And this is at the core of that new space policy edition that we posted on Friday. I did with Casey Dreyer and Jason Callahan, the policy wonks of the Planetary Society.
They are wonks, man. I love them. They are into the details. And really, you guys, everybody listening, the details are really the hard part. I've said this many times, but Washington, D.C. is a small town based on relationships. And you have to get to know people. You have to find out what's reasonable, what's possible. And then you have to encourage people to see it your way. And so we really want the world's largest space agency to set a day to land on Mars. All right, you engaged listeners. Thanks for tuning in. We really are at the Planetary Society. We really are working to change the world. Thank you all.
And how? And he's leading us in that effort. He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy. Let's talk about a cool new book that combines the real universe with the Star Trek universe. We're going to talk with Andrew Fasekas. Oh, to travel among the stars as easily as the Starship Enterprise. Fortunately for we Earthlings, anyone can cross the galaxy from their own backyard. You don't need warp drive, you don't even need a telescope, though even an inexpensive one reveals far more. What you do need is a guide. Andrew Fasekas has volunteered. His book, Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, is subtitled The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. It was published a few weeks ago. That's also when I talked to Andrew via Skype at his home in Montreal. Canadians will recognize him as the Night Sky Guy, heard on CBC Radio Canada. Andrew also writes the Starstruck column at nationalgeographic.com. Andrew, welcome to Planetary Radio, and congratulations on the publication of this really beautiful book.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It is intriguing. Now, I have to admit, the audience knows that I am, if not a Trekkie, the next closest thing to it. I'm a big fan and have been since the original series, which I hear you're a fan of as well. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more Trek. This is, well, you called it in your introduction a bit of a mind meld. What did you mean by that?
That's right, a Vulcan mind meld. I couldn't resist. My passion for stargazing, the night sky, really goes back to my childhood, young childhood. Some of my earliest memories are not only of gazing at the night sky with my dad. We spent so many hours on our rooftop of our apartment building. We lived in downtown Montreal, Canada, and it's very light polluted, but we spent so much time looking through our telescope and then going out on camping trips and really seeing the night sky in all its glory. And then at the same time in my life, I had Star Trek there. Front and center, and that was in the form of watching every week. It was a ritual in my household to get together with my dad on Sundays, and this was probably, I guess this was in the mid-70s, and I would be probably 5-7 years old, something like that. And every Sunday, it was probably one of the first reruns of the original Star Trek series in Canada. I would just sit there with my dad and I would barrage him with tons of questions on what we're watching. You know, I was a very inquisitive little guy, and I guess a real space geek in the making. and so I just asked him about all these amazing things that we were seeing on every episode. How was the spaceship getting to their destination so fast? What about those planets? How could they be breathing the air? And what was that star that they passed by? What was that about? And I think I wore my dad down, and that's when he bought that telescope for us to really start having our own cosmic adventures.
Back to the book. It is pretty amazing visually. I mean, it is rich in the sort of graphics illustrations that I guess you'd kind of expect from National Geographic, but it really is why, in large part, it's a beautiful book, but it's also beautifully written.
Oh, thank you. And you know, I mean, it was a labor of love, really was for me, because it's something that, like I said, has been part of my life since I was a young kid. And then to actually be able to share this passion, you know, this excitement. And that's what I was hoping to convey with the book, is really get that excitement and get people to go out, get excited enough to go outside and look up at the night sky and make that connection with something between the fictional universe and the real universe.
It says right on the cover, the official guide to our universe. What does that mean? Did you get approval by the United Federation of Planets?
as close as I can. Well, better than that, CBS, which
okay. more powerful than the Federation.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a really big deal. We knew right away that CBS, that owns all the rights to the Star Trek characters and episodes, and Paramount Pictures with the movies. We had to get them involved in the book to do it the right way, to do it justice. Because we had to fill it up with as much Trek stuff as we could, you know, Trek content, just squeeze everything out. And I was really lucky, because when we got in touch with CBS, through National Geographic, CBS was really keen on getting involved. They said early on that this was a type of project that they've wanted to do for decades, because Star Trek is so rich with every incarnation of Star Trek in all those different series, there's always more and more added, and more science, you know, and it's a reoccurring foundation that's very solid in Star Trek. So there's lots to, it's in fact a fire hose of information.
We don't want to ignore the many, many illustrations of the real universe.
Oh, and definitely, and that's a big part of the picture too, because, you know, we have these beloved Star Trek episodes and scenes, and they're juxtaposed with the real Hubble images, different NASA missions, European missions that are out there. We're so lucky we have such beautiful, exquisite, hyper-realistic visions practically of the universe available, that we wanted to make sure that the reader really can see the differences and the similarities between Star Trek universe and the real universe. And then follow it up with maps of the night sky as well.
Yeah, you've got star charts in the back for anybody who wants to keep those handy, along with images of some of the things that people might observe in the night sky, even naked eye observations. You know, in some email to you, I said, and I stand by, this would make a pretty good intro to astronomy textbook, with only, you know, a couple of quizzes maybe added at the end of chapters, things like that. It's a good introduction. I mean, you don't have to be a Trek fan, but I suppose that helps.
The appeal of this, I mean, the book's been out now only for a couple of months, but I've been fortunate enough to talk with people at conventions, at different places where I've given talks and stuff. And what I'm getting really interesting is, This is what I really was hoping to get out of the book, is getting like parents who, for instance, do like Star Trek but are also science geeks, getting their kids involved in science and into Star Trek as well. And so that is a parent-child kind of activity that they can do together, is using this book, sitting on the sofa, watching that episode, learning about science, and then doing an activity together by going outside and doing some stargazing, which is a really great bonding type of activity, I think, for families to do. And then on top of that, we also have a different demographic, having teachers out there who've come to me and says this is something they're really considering in their courses. Like, I've had college professors who are doing introduction to astronomy to non-science students.
That's the Night Sky Guy, Andrew Fasekas. We'll talk more about his new book that melds Star Trek and astronomy after a break. This is Planetary Radio.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We're in the midst of talking with Andrew Fasekas about two of my favorite topics, Star Trek and astronomy. Andrew has mind-melded the two in his new book from National Geographic titled Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. There's no shortage of books that introduce the night sky, but this is the first that approaches the topic aboard the Starship Enterprise. My complete, nearly half-hour conversation with Andrew can be heard in the online version of this episode. Anybody who takes on writing about the universe has to come to grips with the fact that by the time the book appears, we're going to have new knowledge. And that came home to me. I was going through the book, and I saw where you were talking about we've charted something like 300 million stars in the sky, and you mentioned the Gaia mission, which, of course, just a couple of weeks ago, we talked about it last week on this show, had its big release of data and has just vastly multiplied the number of stars that we're getting to know in our own galaxy. I mean, you knew that was going to happen when you wrote the book, right?
That's right. In some respects, the book is old already because it deals with 50 years of Star Trek, right? I mean, it's your point. The Trek aspect, the history of Trek, is going to be there, and that won't change. But yes, the astronomical side of things, it's such a fast-paced world we live in now with all the missions out there and the discoveries on a week-to-week basis. Yes, like the Gaia thing, amazing. I read that it was like 400 million stars in that 1.1 billion survey has never even been seen by human eyes before. So that is an impressive number, that right away. And then, of course, things like the planets, exoplanets, the numbers, and what's the newest one, like the very exciting Proxima B discovered just a few weeks ago. You know, I wish that could have been put in there. You know,
well, you could put that in Planet Nine in the second edition of the book.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
What are your favorite sky features?
Oh, in terms of the real night sky, I love, obviously, the planets, and particularly like the Saturn never fails, right? As a science educator, an astronomy educator, I call it the wow planet, because that's the first reaction I get from people. And I do the same thing. It's just like, wow, is this really in front of me in the eyepiece? I can't believe it, what I'm seeing. And then in terms of deep sky targets, like things that are beyond the solar system, star clusters, particularly globular star clusters, are just absolutely, if people are not familiar with what they are, you can think of it as sort of if you had a tablecloth, a black velvet tablecloth, and you're looking down on it, and then you spill a pile of sugar on top, and you look at that pile of sugar, crystalline sugar. That's what it kind of looks like looking into the eyepiece at it. It's like literally hundreds of thousands of stars in a ball shape that stretches maybe 100 light years across, and it's tens of thousands of light years away. It's a city of stars that you're actually looking at in the eyepiece. And through a backyard telescope under dark skies, it is one of the most amazing things in nature that you can behold.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, one of the most gorgeous illustrations in the book is a two-page spread of a particular cluster, Omega Centauri.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the globular star clusters are one of those staples of backyard sky watchers. You have a backyard telescope, even a more modest telescope. The way I divided the book is based on traditional astronomical types of objects. And we went into the globular clusters and looking at that, I knew right away, I mean, you know, you've got such amazing capabilities from like the Hubble Space Telescope and its cousins. We can actually go right into the center of the cluster. And you can see that in the Omega globular cluster. It's a staple for those in the southern hemisphere, in the Centaurus constellation, and it's considered one of the best deep sky targets for an amateur to look at. You are in that image, you're actually seeing it at the heart of the cluster, which to a backyard astronomer, it just looks like they're packed, right? The stars are touching each other, it looks like, which of course they're not. You can see in that spread that they're just, it looks like a Christmas light bulb spread out all across the sky.
It is absolutely, as I said, gorgeous. And I'm glad that you're into the planetary stuff too. You know, we just had our most frequent guest, Linda Spilker, the principal scientist for the Cassini mission on the show. The book is not out of date yet. You've got some beautiful images from the Rosetta mission of that comet. Favorite episode?
Probably one of my all-time favorites is The City on the Edge of Forever, with guest star Joan Collins as Edith Keeler. And it has that time and space travel element, which is I love for any science fiction adventure. And then they throw in a great tragic romantic storyline. And in that episode, by the way, Kirk, you know, he's walking with a romantic walk with Joan Collins, Edith Keeler, and he points up to the sky and points out the Orion constellation and the belt of Orion. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. And I remember that as a child. That's funny enough, doing the project, I kind of remember that. It was a seed that obviously planted in my head, that remembering that episode. And it's like comfort food for me to be able to look at these kind of episodes. There was that connection that it made with me, that idea of where Kirk looked up and actually pointed out a star in the belt of Orion. I don't know, I was looking up that there are people there, there's a planet around that, one of those stars, and captured my imagination. And that's what Star Trek did for an entire generation, is capture that imagination and became a seed for inventors, astronauts, scientists around the world, making a difference in the world, a positive difference.
Andrew, I think a lot more people will get an opportunity to have that experience, partly through your new book, which, again, I highly recommend. It is a beautiful book, Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, from National Geographic. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us about the Trek universe and the real one, which holds just as much, if not much more, wonder.
Oh, thank you so much, Matt, for the opportunity, and live long and prosper.
And LLAP to you as well. Andrew Fasekas is the Starstruck columnist on nationalgeographic.com. He's also a regular contributor to CBC Radio Canada. He writes and watches the skies in Montreal. Another guy who shares his passion for the universe with us on a weekly basis, that's Bruce Betts. He's coming up in this week's What's Up segment right now. Time once again for What's Up on Planetary Radio with Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. Welcome back.
Well, starting the pre-dawn sky, we've got Jupiter is now in the morning sky and getting higher and higher, low in the east. If you've got a really clear view to the east and you look before dawn during this week, the week of the 10th, you may see it near Mercury. Mercury will continue to drop lower and the much brighter Jupiter will get higher. Evening sky, Venus getting higher shortly after sunset as the weeks go along. Super bright, low in the west. Those are your best shots. We move on to this week in space history. It was 1968 that Apollo 7 launched. It was the first Apollo mission to carry humans into space.
Just an orbital mission, right? Earth orbit.
Yes. Yes. Random
space fact. That reminds me of something TV-ish, but I can't place it. If I think of it before we're done, I'll tell you.
So Saturn's moons and their naming. 24 of Saturn's moons are regular, orbiting in a normal kind of way, and traditionally named after Titans or other figures associated with the mythological Saturn. The remaining 38 are all small, irregular, and classified by orbital characteristics into Inuit, Norse, and Gaelic groups in terms of their naming.
Thanks.
We move on to the trivia contest. We asked you, what is the surface gravity on Jupiter's moon Europa given in Gs, where 1G is the surface gravity at Earth's surface? How'd we do, Matt?
Outstanding number of entries, almost all of them correct. Wish we could reward all of you, but I think it's only going to be Tom Van Scotter, a longtime listener, but first-time winner, as far as I could tell, in Shorewood, Illinois. He said that the gravity on Europa is about 0.134G.
That is correct. 13% of Earth's surface gravity.
Congrats, Tom. He also said that the high jump records, about 2.5 meters on Earth, would be over 18 meters on Europa, assuming, of course, a low-mass spacesuit is available. Tom, you're going to get that Planetary Radio t-shirt. We just got a new batch in, so we even have women. For the first time, women's sizes. We've never done that before because we couldn't. And now apparently we can. I don't know why. Planetary Society rubber asteroid, or should I say rubber asteroid, both the men's and women's, and it's unisex, and a 200-point itelescope.net astronomy account, international nonprofit network of telescopes operated from our friends down under. That's what Tom's getting. We heard from Jordan Ticton, Westlake, California. He said that 0.134G on Europa, it's a little over one-third of Mars's surface gravity, which itself is a little over one-third of Earth's. Norman Kassoon gave us a bunch of examples of gravity on different bodies. The one I liked the most was the one on Churyumov-Gerasimenko, Rosetta's comet, 0.00017G. I don't know. Escape velocity, what? A good jog?
I'm pretty sure I could throw you off.
Mel Powell said that if Alan Shepard had hit his famous golf shot on Europa, it would have gone about 23% farther, barring, says Mel, an obstacle on Europa, such as, dare I say it, a water hazard.
Ah, it'd be kind of an icy hazard.
Richard Tolson in Hastings, Nebraska, revealed something I didn't know about you. He says if the weight on Bruce's UFC fighter stats is still correct at 185 pounds, he would weigh about 25 pounds, which would give new meaning to the lightest weight class of atom weight. How have I missed your matches?
This is a history I don't usually discuss in this forum. I try to keep two separate personalities.
Dave Fairchild will close it out this time. He sent us another little poem. Europa's gravity is weak, 0.134 of Earth. It used to be much stronger until Britain pulled its berth. Oh, wait, wrong Europa. A little Brexit humor there. All right, we're done with that stuff.
All right, next question. What moon in the solar system has the longest orbital period around its parent planet? So, obviously, referring to moons we've actually discovered, what moon in the solar system has the longest orbital period around its parent planet? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have this time until the 18th of October, that'd be Tuesday the 18th, at 8 a.m. Pacific time, to get us the answer. Still a rubber asteroid, Planetary Society rubber asteroid, a 200-point itelescope.net account, but we have a copy of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. In other words, the book from National Geographic that we were just talking with Andrew Fasekas about, with a foreword by the Shat himself, William Shatner. It's a beautiful book, and we're going to include that in the prize package this time around. So get those entries in, and we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about Planetary Radio in the Octagon. One night only. Thank you. Good night.
That's our heavyweight. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us here in the Octagon every week for What's Up.
Did you just call me fat?
Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its federated members. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.